Telc English, C1. Mock Examination 1. Listening, Part 1. You will hear a radio program with 8 people giving their opinions on a topic. You will hear each person once. While listening, decide which statement A to J best matches what the speaker says. You will only need 8 of the 10 statements. Mark your answers for items 47 to 54 on the answer sheet S30. You will now have 1 minute to read the statements A to J.
Welcome to this week's edition of What's Your Opinion? Today's topic is the impact of the smartphone. Let's listen to what some people have to say.
Number 47. Some parts of society have been quicker to embrace smartphones than others. Working in education, I see smartphones as a very controversial topic. Of course, they can be a valuable tool for learning, but the problem is many students, particularly low achievers, find the presence of phones too distracting. They can't focus on their work. Studies show that when schools ban smartphones, test scores increase by 6%. Yet, when our school tried to ban them, we met huge resistance, predominantly from parents. Surprisingly, a lot of the students supported the ban, but many parents insisted that their children needed phones in case of an emergency. Of course, parents could call the school itself, but it's more convenient if their kid has a phone, even if science proves that students would be better off without one. Number 48.
I love smartphones, but at the same time, I'm critical of the way smartphones dominate our lives. You see people constantly checking their phones instead of focusing on the people they are with. There seems to be no sense of what's appropriate behaviour. A phone beeps, and immediately the person breaks off conversation to pull out the phone and see who it is. It's like a nervous habit. I don't think people even realise they're doing it, or if they do, that it's extremely rude. Smartphones should come with a warning or a label like medicine. When you're not alone, put it on silent or leave it in your bag. Have some respect for those who gave up their time to be with you.
Number 49.
Experts are always saying that in long-term relationships, communication is key. But I fear many couples are now turning to their smartphones, where before they used to communicate with each other. In the evenings, instead of chatting to each other, now they're individually doing their own thing, eyes glued to their screens. You see the same thing on trains, couples side by side ignoring each other. The smartphone's like a third person in the relationship, always dragging our attention away from the person we're with. It creates a barrier. We can distract ourselves with social media or funny videos rather than connecting with the person sitting right beside us. It's ironic that a tool for communication has become the cause of communication breakdown for so many couples.
Number 50. I just read an article which said that smartphones were making people lazier than ever, and more people are treating them as an extension of our mind. Instead of trying to remember information or work out a simple maths problem, we just reach for our phone. It does all the brain work for us. While we tend to think this is practical and convenient, the researchers said it's actually affecting our cognitive skills, and that it's only going to get worse in the future. Our memory may even be at risk. The article said we should use our brains more and rely on technology less. I have to admit, it's quite shocking, and not something I'd thought about at all. Number 51.
How did people survive before smartphones? As a student who now lives 200 miles away from home, I have to say that my smartphone has been an essential means of keeping in touch with family and friends. I don't need to spend money on travelling home. Instead, I can share my adventures with my friends via social media and have regular video calls with my parents. There's no need for me to feel isolated and cut off from their lives just because I'm not there. I'm not saying that it's a guarantee against homesickness, but being able to reach into my pocket and immediately connect with a loved one at any time gave me the confidence to start exploring and interacting with the new situation I found myself in. It made adjusting to university life simpler.
Number 52.
For people who travel as often as I do, the smartphone has been a godsend. It combines the functionality of multiple tools, reducing the number of things you have to take with you. A music player, maps, a camera or notepad, I have all those in one. With immediate updates on delays or flight changes, a translator function and apps to find and book a hotel in seconds, my business trips have been simplified. I predict that laptops may soon become obsolete as people use the phone to communicate and share information. With Wi-Fi and cloud technology, you can access all your data from anywhere. Some say it's all too much too soon, but for me, these innovations are invaluable.
Number 53.
I think the next change we'll see is smartphone wallet apps replacing credit cards and cash when we pay for things. Many people think it's risky, but that's what was said about credit cards and online purchasing. People are always afraid of change. But there are many advantages to using your phone to pay for things. All your information is in one place: your cards, discount vouchers, and the receipts for each purchase made. Having them together in your electronic wallet makes it easier for you to keep an eye on your finances. Being a student, I need to keep track of my money, so that's a huge plus for me. Of course, paying with a smartphone at the checkout is faster than rummaging around for the right card. I definitely think it's the next big thing.
Number 54.
It's been a while since smartphones were launched on the market, and it's interesting to see the effect they're having on our lives. When they first came out, people claimed they'd either revolutionise life or ruin it. They've definitely improved communication, but there are downsides. People get distracted easily, and because we're constantly checking our phones, we're not as productive as we used to be. We have shorter attention spans, and we're always jumping from task to task. Some people spend an unhealthy amount of time playing games, and others answer work emails around the clock instead of switching off. That can't be good for you either. At the end of the day, though, we make those choices. A smartphone is just a tool. It's how we use it that causes problems.
Well, there have been some interesting contributions. What's your opinion? Ring in and let us know.
End of listening part one. Listening part two. You will hear a radio program. You will hear the program only once. While listening, decide which answer fits best, A, B, or C. Mark your answers for items 55 to 64 on the answer sheet S30. You will now have 3 minutes to read items 55 to 64.
Welcome to Ella's Friday Evening Show. When it comes to organising successful music festivals, there are few who can compete with Graham Barnes. With 25 years' experience, he is one of the industry's most influential people. Today, he's talking to us about London Rocks, a three-day festival celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. Thanks for joining us, Graham.
My pleasure, Ella.
So, Graham, let's go back to the start. How did you get into the field of festival organisation?
Well, Ella, that's a question I often ask myself in the weeks running up to a festival when countless unexpected problems pop up. Ha! The festival scene wasn't an area that interested me initially. Instead, it was something that I kind of fell into. I started working for a record label when I left school, and then a friend who was setting up a small festival in Scotland asked me for advice. I had lots of contacts, so, as a favour to my friend, I convinced a few of them to get involved. The festival was a huge success, and we had such a great time that my friend and I decided to do a second, and then a third, and suddenly, that became my job.
How do you find the right bands for these events?
As well as providing people with some big names, the bands or singers they expect to see, you also have to take a chance. That means surprising people with less well-known bands, or bands that you haven't heard from in ages. Having that element of surprise is what makes your festival unique. You try to match the bands to the festival theme and provide something for everyone, no matter which age group. Some 80s or 90s acts are still very popular, even with people who weren't born when they started making music.
Why do you think it's so important to have newcomers as well as the more famous names?
Well, it's commonly thought that new bands are there because they're cheaper or just to fill in the gaps between the big names. But that really is a misconception. For music lovers, finding an act that then becomes the next big thing is a special feeling. You see a performance, and suddenly you know this particular band or singer is going to be huge. Later, their names are all over the media, and you feel connected to their success. So, while the big names are important to boost ticket sales, the attraction with newcomers is being able to say, "I saw them first." And in my experience, it's often the unknowns that put on the best shows.
Why is that?
Perhaps it's because they have more to gain from playing at a huge festival. They have this amazing opportunity to win over festival goers to their music, so they take risks. Some bands say that because they've dreamed about this for years, they're so nervous they give 110%. All that nervous energy can create something exciting. A great performance at a big festival can make them famous.
Among bands, London Rocks is one of the best love festivals. Why is that?
What makes us interesting is that we have a new focus each year. It's always something different, so it's exciting. And as a result, bands beg to be allowed to play, despite the fact we pay them a lot less than other festivals do. Even the big names are not guaranteed a place on the programme. It all depends on whether they're the right fit.
What size audience can bands reach?
London Rocks draws the biggest crowds of all UK festivals, up to 150,000 people, and it regularly sells out. That's a huge audience, especially for a band trying to establish themselves. But what really sets it apart from competition is that the entire festival is televised and viewed on TV or online throughout the world. Imagine, if even a small percentage of viewers download your album, that could be life-changing for you as an artist.
What else makes London Rocks stand out?
Well, I think to succeed, festivals have to somehow be unique. We said from the beginning that while it's a rock festival, we'd offer other arts. So we added some smaller stages offering comedy and theatre. There's a fun fair too, which is popular, and a huge number of food stalls offering good quality international food. But as I've said time and time again, we don't get distracted trying to be all things to all people. These are merely side attractions. Music shouldn't just be a novelty. It's key to the whole event. That's what drives us, and that's what people are paying for.
Talking about music, when you were younger, did you dream of being a rock star?
People think of me as a frustrated musician who created a festival just to give himself an audience. The truth is that despite childhood attempts at the guitar or piano, I lacked the discipline to master an instrument, and I was never someone that needed the limelight. From an early age, I concentrated on becoming part of the industry. But behind the scenes, you don't have the fame, but you do get a taste of the rock star life.
What about crime? Last year, statistics showed that crime levels at London Rocks have fallen dramatically. Why is this?
Each year, we have 400 police officers on site and excellent security teams at all entrances. They've always done a fantastic job. What caused the decrease was that in order to secure your ticket, you had to go online and submit a photo used to create a ticket photo ID combination. Since this is checked by security at each entry, it's harder for petty criminals to get access to the site. Last year, our security teams reported a 61% decrease in crimes, such as theft and possession of drugs. When surveyed about the change, both festival goers and the police reported being very satisfied. So it's definitely something that will continue.
Finally, I just wanted to ask for your thoughts on the future of the festival industry.
Well, we won't see any slowdown. More and more festivals are appearing, and although that means more competition, most will survive. This is due to the fact that the millennial generation, those who became adults around 2000, prefer experiences over possessions. They are driving the growth in the industry. And their use of social media to share their experiences means that they also market the events. That's what we've learned. Keep the millennials happy, and you'll be sure of success.
Thank you so much, Graham, for taking the time to talk to us.
You're welcome, Ella. End of listening part 2. Listening part 3. You are listening to a PowerPoint presentation. For each slide, there are one or more pieces of information you should note down. While listening, make notes on the right-hand side for items 65 to 74. Answer 0 is an example. You will hear the presentation only once. After listening to the recording, you will have 5 minutes to transfer your answers for items 65 to 74 to the answer sheet S30. You will now have 1 minute to read the slides. Welcome to our lecture series on the wonders of civil engineering, where we look at famous constructions that changed our world. Today, Dr. Jesse Crane, Professor of Architecture Design at Sheffield University, is here to tell us about America's Hoover Dam. Without further ado, I give you Dr. Crane.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here. I've been fascinated by the Hoover Dam since I was a teenager. When on holidays with my family in California, we drove all the way there, about 40 kilometres outside of Las Vegas, just to see it. Today, I'm going to share some interesting facts about it, and perhaps you'll become as fascinated by it as I am. First, we'll start with its construction. The dam was built to control flooding along the Colorado River and to provide water and hydroelectric power for the states in that area. It took 5 years to build, and when it was finished in 1935, Hoover Dam was the world's biggest dam. It stretched 1,244 feet. That's about 380 metres across the Black Canyon. The dam was almost built at a different site, as surveyors initially suggested Boulder Canyon as the perfect location. Everyone spoke about the Boulder Canyon Dam project, and even after the new site at Black Canyon was agreed upon, people still referred to it as the Boulder Dam. The dam was officially given the name Hoover Dam in 1930, in honour of Herbert Hoover, who had become the 31st President of the United States just the year before. But Hoover left office before the dam was completed and was succeeded by Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt's supporters blamed Hoover for the country's economic problems and caused controversy when they decided to revert back to the name Boulder Dam. Yet many other Americans insisted on using Hoover Dam, its original title. To add to the confusion, at the 1935 opening ceremony, Roosevelt himself referred to it as Boulder Dam. This was seen by many as a public critique of Hoover. For years after, both names were used, and mapmakers complained that they were never sure which one to use. Finally, in 1947, a law was passed to officially confirm that the dam would use Hoover's name, and from that point on, there was clarity. But fear not, fans of the name Boulder, it did come in useful. It was used to name Boulder City, the town built to house the 5,000 workers who were given jobs at the dam. Before the town was built, an estimated 42,000 people, unemployed men and their families, had travelled to the area in the hope of finding employment. This was during the Great Depression, just a year after the stock market crash, and people were willing to sacrifice everything to have the chance of work, knowing that a project of this size would need armies of able-bodied men. These people had been settling along the river in tents as soon as the location of the dam had been announced. And as these riverside settlements grew and grew, the decision was made to construct a semi-permanent town. The Dutch-born architect, Zeker Rink de Boer, was contracted to plan it. He was told that, as the town was part of the dam project, it, like the dam itself, should inspire people and make them feel optimistic about the future. The plans included so many parks and green spaces that it was nicknamed Nevada's Garden City. But as it was expected that the town would only accommodate single male workers, schools were not included in the plans, and no provision was made for hospitals. Sick or injured workers had to travel all the way to Las Vegas if they needed treatment. To keep the workers focused, the number of stores that could open was severely limited, and drinking and gambling were strictly banned. Even today, although you can find bars throughout the town, it is the only major city in Nevada without casinos. Today, Boulder City has the reputation as one of the best places to retire to in the United States, and has a population of 15,023. Of course, it's not just male retirees living there. These days, you'll find men and women of all ages among the residents. But back to those first settlers. The actual work they signed up for was tough and dangerous, and they worked 8-hour shifts 7 days a week with only 2 days off a year. And these 2 days holiday were without pay. The workers' wages range from 50 cents to $1.25 an hour. That doesn't sound like a lot, especially when you take into account the number of construction-related deaths that were occurring. There were 96 official fatal accidents with machinery or falling rocks, but most sources say the real figure was probably much higher. Hundreds had their lives shortened by the difficult working conditions. However, despite the popular myth, no workers were buried alive in the dam's concrete as it was poured. Building the dam was an amazing feat of engineering. Nothing of this size had been done before, and it's still the highest concrete dam in the Western Hemisphere, with a height of 221.4 metres. There are lots of statistics about the size of the Hoover Dam, but the one I like most is the fact that it weighs about the same as 18 Empire State Buildings. Lake Mead, which was created as the result of damming the river, is the largest reservoir in the country. It is a stunningly beautiful area and attracts over 10 million visitors a year who enjoy the boating, sailing and fishing facilities. The reservoir covers about 248 square miles and supplies water to homes and businesses in Nevada, Arizona, California and even Mexico. And of course, the dam itself is a very popular tourist attraction. People often ask how Hoover Dam can withstand the massive pressure and weight of Lake Mead, which is constantly trying to flow downriver to the Gulf of California. How did the engineers deal with this problem? Let me give you a brief explanation. The Hoover Dam is an arch dam made of concrete. It curves against Lake Mead and is strengthened at the sides by the massive rock walls of the Black Canyon. And so, because of its curved shape and the support given to it by the rocks of the Black Canyon, Hoover Dam can withstand the huge pressure of Lake Mead. In simple terms, its strength comes from the curved design. I'm now going to talk you through a slideshow which recreates the actual construction of the dam, as it really is much easier to envisage when you can follow the different steps that were taken.
You now have 5 minutes to transfer your answers for items 65 to 74 to the answer sheet S30. End of the listening subtest.